chair the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Public Safety Subcommittee for Wednesday, April 13th, 2005. This is a public hearing on House Bill 5016, the Department of Corrections budget bill. I'd like to thank all the members of the participants in the audience. We appreciate that you're here this afternoon. Other members of the committee will be arriving shortly, with the exception of Senator Winters. I think many of you have been following her progress since she had the triple bypass surgery. She's doing well. Her recovery is going great, but she's not quite ready to do full days yet. But we do expect to see other members of the committee. It is our intent to meet from now until around 4 p.m. It's our intent to hear from everyone who's come to testify today. We will be hearing your testimony in the order that you signed up. And we will be taking testimony from those who traveled more than 100 miles. Those who traveled more than 100 miles, we will be hearing your testimony first. It looks like we have roughly 25 or so people signed up thus far. And so in looking at how much time would be allotted for each person to speak, I think we have about roughly 5 minutes per person. So we just ask that you please acknowledge and honor your 5 minutes, remembering that there are people behind you also wishing to testify. I would also ask that if you feel inclined to applaud, please hold your applause, but if you want to let the committee know your sentiment, you can always let us know in that manner, and we will proceed. Okay, it looks like the first person we have signed up from 100 miles or more is Shirley Malcolm, and I'm going to call up three people at a time. Shirley Malcolm. A couple more from 100 miles or more? Okay. We'll just be at ease until we get that. If you'd like to go ahead and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Shirley Malcolm, and I'm a small-town doctor from what I call the deep south of Oregon. I come from Jacksonville and Josephine County. I am a person who received a call in 1999 that would be the chill to the bone of most parents. And it was from my son who said, "Mom, I'm in trouble. I've relapsed. I'm in Portland. I'm arrested." That started a journey for me that opened my eyes to the current management of crime in Oregon and opened Michael's eyes to 16 years of Measure 11. I recently came to Salem to visit with my representatives. As I sat in the hall waiting, I met another woman, and the corollaries in our life was profound. She also had a son who was deeply steeped in addiction, and she also had a son who had committed and been charged with crimes that extended over approximately a week, and which could be called stupid robbery crimes. As we talked, I found out another commonality was that each of our sons were serving the first of 16 years in prison. I sat down and tabulated the cost, and that would be an accumulation of 32 years times a very conservative $30,000 a year, or those two individuals will cost our community $1 million, nearly $1 million. Two individuals out of 12,000 will take nearly $1 million from our community resources under the current plan. And most sadly, as I've researched it and gained experience, in the current trends, those two will be discharged old, without Social Security benefits, without having job skills, people skills, and probably with fragmented health and fragmented family. And unfortunately, they are not the exception. Recidivism is also very common and fairly stable. If you look back to the DOC's numbers of recidivism in the late 80s and 90s, depending on gender, age, culture, it's between 30% and 40%. So these two young men will be likely to be in that 40% who, despite their long years, return within 36 months of yet other crimes and more victims. California, interestingly, has recently declared their recidivism is approximately 60%, so it is a major problem. What I'd like to make is a respectful 3 points. One is to work, all of us, to educate the public to be smart on crime so that when you seek to make changes, you feel supported as our representatives. And I think that takes education, education, education. I know that your hands are locked in many ways. Two, you write our budgets, so chase down the buck. If you know on April 30th that of the 12,000 people in our prisons, 4,700 or more are Measure 11, ask the DOC, how many years does that represent? And do your own calculations. Take it times 30,000 minimally. And I think you'll be appalled at the sticker price for our future citizens of Oregon. And three, care about victims deeply. Victims represent not only what has happened, but what will happen. When instead of our state trying to absorb, as they did in the late 80s, 40% of 4,000, we're going to be trying to absorb 40% of 12,000 people who are likely to be back in 36 months. So I ask that you think in terms of diverting funds from warehousing to rewiring. It's our only chance of saving our budget in this lovely state of Oregon. And so I submit this to you as someone who has experienced it, and I respect you and think you've got a very rough job ahead of you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And could you say again where you are from, Ms. Malcolm?
I'm from Jackson County.
Thank you so much for making the trip over. We appreciate
Thank you
being here and for setting the tone for the rest of the testimony.
You're certainly welcome.
Thank you. Let's see. I want to make sure we get anyone else who's 100 miles or more. Okay. Mr. Rick Allen, mayor of Madras.
Madam Chairman, there's one person signed up, so you can, we'll combine our times kind of here, if that's okay.
That's fine. That would be Parrish. Is it Van Wert?
Correct.
Also from Madras. Welcome.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you, Madam Chairman, Representative Hansen, and Representative Hanna. I'm glad you guys got switched back around because that was, you weren't going to get away with that. Thank you for the invitation to speak. And yesterday, I should have jumped up to the table with the director when you invited me, and I didn't have anything prepared, so that's why I didn't do that. But I appreciate the offer. We have a few people with us, and I'll just introduce them, and that way they don't have to speak. I've sat through 25 years of being in the hearings and things, and it's repetitive in nature, so we will avoid you that. But with us, we have Delita Cortes from Madras, and Doug Ertner, who chairs the Prison Advisory Committee, and John Hatfield, and that is a Mark Hatfield relative. Of course, Parrish is here, Dr. John Wall, and Mike Morgan, our city administrator.
Welcome to all of you. Thank you for making the trip over.
We don't know about prisons and numbers, so I'm not going to sit here and quote those kinds of things, and I think the people in the business have obviously been going over the forecasts and all of that stuff. So, and we're not in the business of Measure 11, or it's kind of like the facilities are at the end of the process. You know, it's how they get there is up with Measure 11 and the courts and everything, but when a body gets turned out that system, they have to go somewhere. And that's what we're here to talk about. I was actually chair of the county commission 10 years ago when then the governor Kitzhaber started into trying to find places for facilities. And in fact, the Wilsonville people came and taped all of our meetings. And then they went on and worked the process in Wilsonville that you all remember so well. Years went by, and there's been lots of different delays and lots of things. You know, they've done a lot of things to reduce the number of inmates and you know, made the system more efficient. So the need for our facility was always moved back, which was fine. We, about four years ago, Department of Corrections came to Manders. You know how they blow up the big check? You know, you've all seen that. And this initial deposit to the city of Manders so that we could start buying property for sewer systems and so on. You have to realize that as a perspective here, 2,000 inmates in a town of 5,000, that would be like adding 200,000 people to the city of Portland and tell you you must make room for them for sewer, water, roads, and housing in 24 months. So you have to get going quickly. So we did. We went out. We bought 1,200 acres to, 600 acres. It was $1,200 an acre. Cheap. But to put effluent on. We went to the ballot in our school system to build a school. We're paying almost $2 a thousand for that school. Today, the school sits half empty. In fact, it's just opening this next September. We added onto our sewer plant, a sewer system that's at 10% capacity. Bottom line to all of that is that then we've been kind of stuck having to pay the bills because the state came and said we're moving forward, this facility is going to be built, and it didn't happen. But those things, that's, you know, the legislature had budget crises, and so there's no one to blame at all. It's what had to be. We're here today to tell you we support the governor's budget. The governor has included the facility in his budget. And I believe the House, or at least, you know, it's hard to know what I read in the paper, but I think the House people support it. Is that true, sir? So we're here to hope that the Ways and Means Committee here will see to it and fund that facility and so that we can get going. We're building roads out to that area right now. We're in the process of having to put sewer lines under the ground, and you're either going to have to build a 6 or 8-inch line or a 10 or a 12-inch line. And Gary, Representative Hansen, you know the cost difference on that. And it's really a problem for us if we don't get some resolution to this, you know, here pretty soon. The community is ready and is supportive. We've opened our arms to this, and we're ready to start construction and get it going. If there's anything you can do, pass this along as timely as possible, we would appreciate that.
Thank you very much, Mayor Allen. Mr. Van Wert.
Just to echo a little bit about what the mayor was saying, our community has braced itself for this, but moreover, on a more global aspect of understanding what the projections from the DOC is placing in inmate population, it would appear as though this is the right time to build the prison, and that the cost factors of waiting and of the delay will cost the state of Oregon many more millions of dollars. $60 million is the last figure that we heard in upcharges to build it, not to mention millions of dollars in bed rental. And we obviously are hearing today a little bit about Measure 11 and understanding that there are quite a number of bills that you're currently going through that would also increase jail sentencing. So while you may relax in one area, you're actually adding to another, and it may end up being a wash at the end of the day. What we're concerned about is obviously the impact to our community of having this project built, but also saving the taxpayers of Oregon the upcharges and delay.
Mr. Van Wert, you are representing the Madras Chamber
of Commerce.
Chamber of Commerce. All right. again, thank you very much for coming over. We appreciate your testimony on the
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Well, just a very quick comment, and that's that I certainly appreciate the effort that Madras has put out over this last decade to help the state solve a very, very vexing problem. And your community spirit and being willing to work with the state has been incredible, and you deserve our thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay, now, is there anyone else who traveled 100 miles or more who did not get on the sign-up sheet? The next three people include Bridget Sarabi, David Rogers, and Robert Reynolds. And I would ask you to please identify yourselves for the record. I neglected to do that with the first panel. Please go forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bridget Sarabi, and I am the Executive Director of Western Prison Project. We're a regional nonprofit organization that works for safe and sensible criminal justice policies that can save taxpayer dollars, reduce recidivism, and keep the public safe. I know that your job is very tough. I've been sitting in on most of these hearings. We have very limited resources and great needs. So I come before you today with good news. I'm going to outline some responsible options that support crime reduction, protect public safety, and that I believe can save at least $100 million over the next 4 years. We heard yesterday in the Senate Judiciary Committee that Oregon now ranks number 5 in the nation in per capita spending on its prison system. The question is, are we making investments that will both reduce crime and victimization and reduce the cost to taxpayers? The short answer is no. I say this having regularly attended the DOC budget hearings for the past 3 sessions. Over 3/4 of our prison population have an alcohol and drug problem. But according to the figures from the department, 47% of prisoners with the most severe substance abuse problems are not receiving treatment during their term of incarceration. Prison education programs reduce recidivism by 15% to 20%, and yet 44% of our prisoners who need basic education services are not receiving them during their term of incarceration. Madam Chair and members of the committee, these continuing program cuts are simply unconscionable, and they put public safety at risk. I say this as a taxpayer and as a survivor of a serious and violent crime. I also say this as the mother of a formerly incarcerated young woman who, thanks to alcohol and drug treatment, is soon celebrating 7 years clean and sober and has successfully returned to our community. The proposed budget also recommends a huge increase to build yet another prison. The startup and debt service costs alone are nearly $22 million in the upcoming biennium and another $34 million in the next, and this doesn't include any money for operating or the actual COPs. I understand that there are many reasons for building a prison. Some folks believe it's good economic development for rural communities. National peer-reviewed research released in the past 2 years studying prison building in the United States from 1969 to 2000 by county throughout the country shows that just the opposite is true. Rural towns with prisons compared to similar towns without prisons are significantly worse off down the road. I'd be happy to supply that study to the committee. Having sat through budget hearings during the last 2 regular sessions and the 6 special sessions of 2002, which were quite memorable, I also know that another unintended benefit of past prison construction was the tens of millions of dollars in borrowed funds that were not spent on construction, funds that were then used to offset general fund budget cuts in tough times. Well, times are still tough in this state, which is all the more reason not to take on another $200 million in debt. From a taxpayer's perspective, the only valid reason for building an expensive new prison is because we have no choice. Attached to my testimony is our handout, Rethinking Prison Expansion, which outlines some solid and sensible options that can eliminate the need to build Madras at this time, including proceeding with the planned expansions at existing facilities like Coffee Creek, rental of available county jail beds, including the empty 500-bed Wapato Jail. Modest expansions of earned time for lower-level offenders, as outlined in Senate Bill 435, which the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission and Sue Porter estimate will save us $30 million over the next 4 years, twice as much as this committee was originally told. Expansion of the Alternative Incarceration Program. This combination of safe and sensible alternatives can provide enough beds to accommodate projected system growth through the next two biennia. Not building matters at this time saves approximately $56 million over the next 4 years in startup costs and debt service. These two responsible options, further delaying construction and moderate non-Measure 11 sentencing reform, can save Oregon taxpayers between $80 and $90 million over the next 4 years. I have even more good news. Millions more could be saved from the DOC budget and future crime reduced if you expand the promising alternative incarceration program, the program over at the Baker City Prison. This program combines intensive drug and alcohol treatment with a sentence reduction for those eligible prisoners who successfully complete the program. The net savings to taxpayers for each prisoner who completes this program is $20,000 in reduced incarceration costs, and untold savings in drunk driving accidents, drug addiction, and violence spurred by substance abuse. We strongly urge you to direct the DOC to expand the AIP program to 500 beds as soon as possible. They have the necessary facilities for program expansion, and by expanding to 500 beds, we can save Oregon taxpayers a minimum of $9 million per biennium in reduced incarceration costs. These savings would more than cover the cost of the other substance abuse treatment programs and cognitive programs that have been proposed for cuts, programs we desperately need. And compared to the current budget proposals, these programs are good bets both to lower crime rates, lower the net cost of crime to both crime victims and taxpayers, and I think this gives us a win-win situation. So I urge you to protect prison programs, expand the alternative incarceration program, and put off building another costly prison in the upcoming biennium. I've also attached to my testimony, written testimony from several residents of Madras who couldn't be here today because they couldn't get off work. And these are folks who would rather see the prison not be built.
Thank you, Mr. Robbie. You referenced a study on rural towns with prisons.
Yes, I have a copy with me today that I could leave with either you or with Doug.
You would make that available to the committee, please.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Mr. Rogers.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Rogers, and I'm the Associate Director of the Western Prison Project. Recently, I've researched what states are doing around the country to strengthen prison programs, and I'd like to share a little bit of what I've found. And based on what I've found, I'm also here today to implore you not to cut prison-based programs and drug and alcohol treatment programs within prisons. Prison programs and prison-based treatment are proactive strategies that promote public safety by reducing future crime, by helping prisoners transform themselves and successfully transition back into our communities. Lawmakers have a very clear choice. We can continue down a path where we sink hundreds of millions of dollars into expensive bricks and mortar, or begin to invest limited resources more wisely. There are a growing number of states who are saving millions of dollars by maintaining and expanding prison-based drug and alcohol treatment programs, including Texas, California, Delaware, and Connecticut. I'm just going to mention a few of the findings that you'll find in my written testimony. First, prison-based treatment reduces recidivism. In Texas, a 3-year study of prisoners who completed prison-based treatment and aftercare were 75% more likely to stay out of prison than those who didn't receive treatment. In California, a 5-year study showed that prisoners who completed a continuum of prison-based treatment and aftercare were more than 200% less likely to be reincarcerated. That same study also showed that prisoners completing treatment were 55% more likely to gain and sustain employment on the outside. Second, prison-based treatment and other programs save money. The Washington State Institute for Public Policy, which is a legislatively created nonpartisan research group, reports that when programs can achieve even a small amount of reduction in crime, they can be cost beneficial. I took the benefit of actually sharing that report with you. It's paper clips to my written testimony with a one-page summary of the findings. That report examined credible research around the country to assess what types of programs successfully reduce crime while saving money. They calculated benefit-to-cost ratio based on both taxpayer savings in dollars and benefits to crime victims. That report estimated that prison-based treatment programs offer a $6 benefit to every dollar of cost. In Connecticut, recent research also showed that for every dollar invested in prison treatment programs, the state avoided $6 in future corrections-related costs, or a staggering $37,000 per prisoner who participated. States around the country realize that prison-based treatment, education, and cognitive programs are smart investments. More importantly, they prevent future crime and victimization. Yet here in Oregon, the governor's proposed budget for the next biennium proposes a $2 million cut to the DOC drug and alcohol treatment programs. That's almost a third of the already meager $7.1 million currently budgeted for treatment programs. While Pathfinders and WICS, Women and Community Service, two very successful programs at reducing recidivism, are also proposed to be cut. I respectfully suggest that such proposed cuts are penny wise but pound foolish. We should not be cutting these programs, rather we should be investing in them. At least we need to meet the needs of people, prisoners with severe addiction problems. Many of you are familiar with the national and state statistics. The Department of Corrections has the capacity to meet the needs of only 53% of prisoners with severe addiction problems. In order to meet the needs of prisoners with severe addiction problems, we would need to increase our capacity by 219 beds. I realize that institutional change often comes slowly, but by adding 219 treatment beds, that seems like a reasonable goal when looking at the alternative. Finally, you have a very important choice ahead of you. Cutting prison programs puts Oregon behind the curve and directly at odds with proven and cost-effective approaches to curbing exorbitant costs of recidivism and incarceration. You can continue down this unsustainable and short-sighted path regarding the growth of the Oregon prison system, or begin to steer us towards a smarter and more cost-effective strategy. In a fiscal climate where everyone is being asked to do more with less, this is one of the very few areas in the state budget where we can save money, improve service, and make a much wiser use of our tax dollars. The evidence is clear. Programs like Alternative to Incarceration Program, or AIP, WICS, and Pathfinders reduce future crime, reduce victimization, and save us money and bed space. Improving these programs is a win-win for everyone. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers. And just an FYI, we have asked the department to look at where else in the budget they can take cuts in order to bring back the programs that you referenced in your testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Solomon?
Reynolds. Excuse me. Robert Reynolds.
And you have, I'm sorry, Mr. Reynolds. And
yes.
You have 5 minutes, Mr. Reynolds.
Thank you very much. Chair Gordley, members of the committee, excuse me, my name is Robert Reynolds. I'm from Portland, from Senator Gordley's district, in fact, and I'm here as a concerned citizen whose attention has been drawn to the criminal justice reform needs of Oregon by having had a family member incarcerated in the past. I'm not prepared with the compelling statistics that I've been hearing from the previous two testifiers, but I'd like to present a point of view, and I'll try to stay close to my written testimony so as to not run over. Oregon's fiscal crisis has resulted in part from mischaracterizing certain of our problems. One of these is the problem of crime. If our problem is seen as how can we be tough on crime, the answer tends to be identify many activities as offenses, arrest and convict as many less defined offenders as possible, make sentences as inflexible as possible, and keep convicts out of circulation for as long as possible. With a determination to see the need as toughness, it's no surprise that we find ourselves with so many offenders that we were unable to house them in prisons. The question then seems to become, how do we build more prisons? How do we operate them less expensively? The temptation is to authorize the expenditure of $190 million for a new prison in Madras, apparently. This is not just an Oregon problem. Nationally, we imprison a larger fraction of our population than does any other industrialized country. Are we a nation of extraordinary miscreants, or could we be doing something wrong? Which do you believe? Our Oregon problem is particularly vexing because our schools must compete with the Department of Corrections for operating funds. Schools are losing, and citizens are noticing and caring. If our problem is instead seen as how do we get smart on crime, the answer looks dramatically different. We are then inclined to answer, identify activities that may not best be defined as requiring prison for their solution, such as mental illness and drug abuse, and decriminalize them. Figure out how to minimize the number of citizens who begin to commit crimes. Figure out how to reduce recidivism among the citizens who do commit a crime. Figure out how to minimize the impact on victims and to maximize restitution for those who are nevertheless victimized. With this approach, we will make very different decisions about allocation of scarce resources. Soon, I trust, we will get helpful local data from the Criminal Justice Policy Research Institute at Portland State University. But there is already evidence from other states, indeed from other nations, such as Finland, Canada, and Japan, suggesting that alternatives to imprisonment are very often strikingly more effective than imprisonment. That's in reaching the goals I mentioned above. And that even with imprisonment, systematic programs of vocational training, drug treatment, and cognitive restructuring are much more cost-effective than mere incarceration, both from the view of the taxpayer and from the view of victim restitution. To build new prisons is to postpone getting smart on crime and is ultimately seriously counterproductive. It adds to the problem. To fund effective programs both in existing prisons and as an alternative to prison is to seize a great opportunity for statewide community building and for social healing, both of which are desperately needed in Oregon and in America. You have it in your power to do enormous good. Please avoid the tempting error of authorizing financing a prison in Madras. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for being present this afternoon. We appreciate it. The next panel, Commissioner Lisa Nato, Judy Shiprack, and Sheriff Raul Ramirez. Are they here?
Yeah. I didn't sign myself up.
Oh, if someone did. So if you're not, if you're not here to testify, we'll
let the next go. I don't see the sheriff.
Okay. We will go then to Paul Solomon and Jared Brown and Mike MacArthur. Why don't you hold for the next panel, Mr. MacArthur? So this is Paul Solomon and Jared Brown.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Madam Chair.
Identify yourself for the record, and if you're part of an organization, let us know what that is, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Solomon. I'm the Director of Men's Services at Sponsors Incorporated in Eugene. Sponsors has been providing reentry services to ex-offenders in Lane County for the last 30 years. I'm here today to ask you to restore the cuts that are being proposed to prison programs. It is critical that these cuts be restored. I also suggest to you that we expand on the prison programs that we know work. We have highly effective, evidence-based practices right at our fingertips. Among the most successful programs are the alternative incarceration programs that are currently being operated at Shutter Creek, Coffee Creek, and Powder River Correctional Institution. As you know, these programs offer sentence reductions of up to 30 months, thereby reducing future incarceration costs of roughly $24,000 annually per person. Unfortunately, these programs account for a mere 412 beds out of a system that now houses nearly 13,000 inmates. These programs equate to fewer future victims and reduce collateral costs of crime and incarceration. As an agency, we have accepted a large number of program graduates. In fact, we have served nearly every boot camp graduate released to Lane County since Shutter Creek Correctional Institution opened. As a whole, they are better prepared, have a greater stake in their future, and transition back into the community with greater success than those who do not have the benefit of such programming. Our state is in a budgetary crisis. We know what works. Let's build upon these evidence-based practices that save the state precious general fund dollars. I personally spent over 9 years in state and federal prison. Without the benefit of prison programming, I would not be here today. I would not have a degree from the University of Oregon, and I would not be assisting other ex-offenders in their reentry process. Prison drug treatment gave me the tools to successfully navigate a path of lasting sobriety. Prison education programs fostered my drive for a degree. All of these programs offer meaningful instruction and, equally important, provide a constructive use of time. Cutting prison programs is a prelude to idle time for offenders, criminal activity, and antisocial behavior. We cannot expect offenders to magically rehabilitate themselves in an environment void of education, cognitive restructuring, and drug treatment. According to the DOC, 75% of all incarcerated offenders have moderate to severe substance abuse issues. However, only 2.2% of the DOC budget is dedicated to prison programs that include religious services, cognitive restructuring, education, and drug treatment. Eventually, nearly every person in state custody will be released. It is in the public's best interest that these individuals be prepared to transition back into the community effectively. Successful reentry begins in prison. It should include sex offender treatment, which is shamefully non-existent in the state of Oregon, in Oregon prisons. Residential drug treatment, education, vocational training, job preparation, and anger management. We have a choice today: build new prisons and pay for their continued operation, or to expand the AIP programs, increase earned good time for inmates, and use these funds for education and other much-needed social services. Weighed against the cost of recidivism, funding prison programs should be a simple equation. Public safety and fiscal responsibility dictate that you should provide treatment and programming for prisons. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jared Brown, and I am a graduate from the 49th community of the Oregon Summit Boot Camp Program. And I'm here today to ask you to support and fully fund prison programs. I became addicted to heroin while attending college at the University of Oregon. My drug addiction quickly led to crime as a means to support my habit. In 2001, I was arrested on burglary and theft charges and sentenced to 34 months in prison. After 1 year in general population, I was accepted into the Summit Boot Camp Program. This program and all its components saved my life. The year that I spent in general population showed me firsthand the importance of alternative programs. The attitudes and behaviors that led me to prison were nothing but reinforced in the general population environment. I felt that any sort of positive change was generally looked down on, mistrusted, and as such very difficult to achieve in that environment. I felt as if there were no way to learn the skills that I obviously needed to return to society as a functioning, contributing member. I spent many hours wondering where the corrections part of DOC came into play. This question was answered for me when I finally made it to boot camp. The difference between this program and general population was day and night. With classes such as Pathfinders, I was able to learn and practice those much-needed skills. I was able to find a way to fit into society, drug-free and productive. Here, positive change was reinforced by staff as well as by my fellow inmates. Old behaviors were not tolerated at all. I was able to change as a direct result of what I learned in the classes offered at boot camp. In the final phase of boot camp, staff holds a review of each inmate. In this review, the question is asked of each inmate, "Would you want this person as your neighbor?" It is a similar question that I asked the committee today. Whom would you want as a neighbor? Someone who has been taught the skills necessary for positive behavioral change, or someone who has not been taught these skills? For me, it's all in the name, Department of Corrections. It's not Department of Stay the Same. I was able to correct my behavior because of prison programs offered to me. Please allow others the same chance, and please fully fund and support these programs. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brown, and thank you for sharing your experience with us. Thank you. Thank you both. Calling again, Mike MacArthur. And then Mr. Phillips isn't signed up.
No, or Paul Snyder. He signed up on page 3.
On page
3. You can sign up together.
Oh, I see. All right. Well, come on up. Come on up together. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of this committee, I'm Mike MacArthur, the Director of the Association of Oregon Counties. We're here today to talk to you about the community corrections element of the Department of Corrections budget. Before I enter into our specific testimony, I want to comment a little bit about the ways and means process. I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding here about the roles the counties play, and I don't mean this as any disrespect to Madam Chairman or the members of the committee, but in effect, counties are acting as the state in this regard as we deliver these programs, and feel that we would have appropriately been in the overview section of the ways and means process. This is our first opportunity, actually, to speak to the function that the counties play in the community correction system, and we appreciate that, but we will approach this as if we were doing the orientation portion of the presentation. And
may I seek a clarification?
Yes.
The overview that you're speaking of, are you speaking of the overview, the public safety overview that occurred at the beginning of the legislative session when we brought the three committees together to hear from the various agencies that make up the public safety and judicial system? Is that the overview you're speaking of?
Madam Chair, the overview I was referring to is phase one of the ways and means process.
Okay. We can talk about that later, but I'm going to take your constructive criticism to heart, and I want to explore with you outside of this hearing what the impact has been for you and those that you represent. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. A quick review of the what we call, refer to fondly as 1145 or House Senate Bill 1145. As we know, this grew from the ballot measure 11 initiative when then Governor Kitzhaber and our Attorney General Theodore Kulongoski brought to the counties a proposal that the counties take on some of the responsibility for the prison population and the supervision of those felons on parole and probation. And this all occurred in 1995, as you all, many of you know. We've worked with that system for the last nearly 10 years now. There are many counties that are experiencing financial difficulty today as a result of Measure 50 and are taking a closer look at the original agreement as it was put in statute regarding the state's responsibility there. Why we did 1145, the reasons were good, and they make a lot of sense. To give you a little bit of a specific example, I was the Sherman County judge at that time. Our prisoners were housed in the state of Washington. We had no county jail. Our parole and probation services were supervised by a fellow who had his office in Junction City, Oregon. As a result of 1145, four counties in our region went together, built a jail, the Norcor facility, which is a very successful county jail. We passed historic legislation to pass a bond levy across four counties' boundaries to build that jail. Sherman, Gillum, Wheeler have a county parole and probation program now with two people there. This program has never paid for itself in Sherman County. Sherman County has always paid the cost of the incarceration of the felons because of the small scale that we have. So this program I've seen be a great success. The issue about what's the appropriate level of funding has vexed us for the entire time the program has been running. I served on the 1145 Implementation Committee when a certain Commissioner Hansen from Multnomah County graduated to the legislature, and I replaced him. and sat through many meetings about the formulas and the proper ways to determine the costs of the system. There was much trepidation between the counties and the state, I think, when we entered into this partnership. The state felt that perhaps the counties wouldn't be as vigilant as necessary in protecting the public safety, that we would turn too many people out on the street rather than pay the cost of having them in jail. The counties, of course, were concerned about maintaining the costs. In the meetings that we held with the Department of Corrections prior to entering into the agreement, we were led to believe by the Department of Corrections that the costs of this program and the new costs would be covered by counties. AOC has continued to work on this process, and there's currently a work group meeting that Paul Snyder is part of, and our board Monday reviewed the agreement that work group has come to, and we essentially endorse the memo that you have in your packet from Craig Campbell of March 31st, 05, which says that we're in agreement with the concepts of the work group to work with the formula from the past biennium, except that we believe it should be adjusted for current service level as listed in the statute. Also, the memo calls for a 10-year review of actual costs. We agree with the sheriffs and believe it should be 6. But we think there's a model here for progress to be made toward determining what the actual costs were and finally putting this to bed, if you will. So, Madam Chair, I'd like to refer to my colleague Paul Snyder, who can provide a bit more detail about that program.
Thank you very much, Mr. MacArthur, and to Mr. Snyder, I want to apologize for referring to you as Mr. Phillips, because I do know who you are. I'm glad to see you this afternoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And before you start, Senator Devlin.
Madam Chair, I had a request, actually. Given that there are so many people here waiting to testify, I would actually have a lot of questions for these parties, but I don't want to ask them now because that would take time away from the parties mm-hmm. that are here. And I know how difficult your schedule is and how many things you still have to have go through the committees in the days. But if we could get them before the committee, I don't want to actually prevent you from testifying. I just have a lot of questions, but I just don't want to ask them here in this venue because it's taking time away from other people that came here to testify.
Senator Devlin, I appreciate that, and I've already made a note that we need to create an opportunity for that conversation to take place, and we will. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, we're happy to return whenever you have the time.
Representative Hansen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to chime in on that same subject, that I think it'd be very important, considering the partnership that we have with counties in corrections, that to maybe set aside a specific amount of time to involve Association of Oregon Counties and perhaps Mr. Campbell from the Governor's Office and Mr. Williams and have a real in-depth discussion of the community correction funding portion.
Very good. Please continue, Mr.
Thank you. Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Paul Snyder with Association of Oregon Counties. Madam Chair, given the dialogue that just occurred and the other witnesses who are present here today, in consideration of the fact that they have just one opportunity, I'd be pleased to just hold my testimony until later.
Thank you very much. We appreciate that. And again, we look forward to another opportunity to explore the issues that you want to bring forward and that we're all concerned about. Thank you. Thank you very much.
I got rid of them pretty quick.
let's see. Mikkel or Mikkel Lewis? Amy McKillop? And Annette Jolin.
Not sure. I don't think Annette was able to get here. Something has delayed her. My name is Michael Lewis, and I am here supporting prison programs. I am a member of the WICS Life Skills Program at Coffee Creek, and I did come and speak to some of you individually several weeks ago. As you know, we've been cut out of the budget, and so we're here to ask that you put us back on the budget and fully fund this very necessary program. There's currently 919 women residing at Coffee Creek. I do believe that has gone up some since I wrote this a few weeks ago. I know we got another 14 women in the other day, and I don't know how many left to balance that. So our capacity number at Coffee Creek is 928. We're not supposed to be at that until 2008, and we're there now. The governor's budget has allowed for 324 new beds to go into Coffee Creek, which again represents the great need for the life skills program so that we can keep these women from coming back. The transitional programs are the most proven way to reduce recidivism rate in female offenders. The life skills program provides support for the offenders as they go back into the community. We provide 85 to 90 women a year with 12 weeks of very intensive programming, case management, pre-release planning, counseling, group counseling. We follow them for a minimum of 1 year after their release with case managers and mentors to make sure that they are doing well. We're following them, we're keeping them out of prison and making them successful, helping them to be successful women in the community. The 1 year cost of a return to custody for a parole violation is $23,451 a year, which at 919 women comes out to just under $22 million a year. Our program costs $280,000 a year to keep it maintained at where it is. Of course, we always would like to double it or triple it, but just maintaining it at that number is $280,000. If you use the reduction in recidivism that this program has proven since 1992 over and over again to drastically cut the recidivism rate down from the state average, and just if you just take 10%, which we're actually more than that, but just a 10% reduction in 1 year, we save $1.5 million for the state in that rate. For $280,000 investment, that's a pretty good return. I can't say we could find that anywhere else. And that is just in the incarceration cost alone. That does not include the extended costs that are never considered in this. So the children who are in foster care and the grandparents who are taking care of children and needing food stamps. And, you know, we've talked about all that before. It goes on and on, all those outside costs that come up. The mothers who are released back into the community with this program are able, 89% of the women who release from our program have a job within the first year, usually less than that. 3 months, they have jobs, they're working, they're finding housing. If they're working, they're paying taxes, they're shopping at the community stores, their children are getting better care because we've given them the parenting skills and the skills that they need to take care of them. And then the juvenile crime goes down because we've got parents who are taking care of it. So that snowball effect, there is no way to put a number on that. We have so many women who want in this program who are not able to take because we just don't have the funding. We have the funding for the 85. Well, we've had the funding for 85 women a year, and that's all we've been able to do. We have to turn women away. And that money that is saved from what we spend now could educate another 500 women a year. We release 600 women a year from Coffee Creek. We're only being able to educate 85 of them. Imagine what would happen if we were able to educate more of them and how much better our communities would be. The overall savings, you know, I think is pretty clear. I listed it out for you in my stuff so you can look at it again. I just think it's an injustice to the society as a whole to not fund this program, let alone just to the women. So, you know, I'm here again to just respectfully ask that you add this back into the budget and fully fund this program as well as others. We consistently have proven ourselves since 1992 in Oregon, in the prison system, to be a very successful program. And we continue to maintain a high volunteer We have over 200 active volunteers, women in the community who work with this program to keep it being able to go with this minimal funding.
Thank you.
We really appreciate that. And we
Ms. Lewis, and I want to apologize for mispronouncing your first name.
Oh, that's
I
all right.
I apologize. Amy McKillen?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome.
I'm here today to ask you to fully support all the programming within the prison system in the state of Oregon, particularly WICS. I believe that if it were not for WICS, I wouldn't be leading the life that I live today. Less than a year ago, I was an inmate at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility in Wilsonville. I was close to paroling after serving almost 3 years for robbery, and I didn't know where I was going to go. I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. I really had no direction. I had taken cognitive classes such as Pathfinders and Breaking Barriers, and they had definitely helped me, but I still needed more. That was when I got into the WICS program. They not only helped me to face my fears about returning to society, but they helped me set goals that were attainable and achievable. And so many women need this program. Men need help as well, but I believe that women face particular problems when they're released back into the community. As it is, like Michael mentioned, between 60 and 70 women each time a class is available are eligible to go, and only 17 get to be in the program. This leaves so many women to fend for themselves when they return home. Please don't take away what little help there is. I've been out of prison for 10 months. Before I left, the people at WICS helped me apply to college, and they also helped me with a resume and interview techniques. Because of their help, I am now living a life I never thought possible. I am currently a student at Portland State University with a grade point average of 3.77, and I work at Oregon Health and Science University for a neuro-oncologist. And I got my job through volunteering for WICS after my release, because, as she mentioned, they follow you out into the community and make sure that you're hanging in there. I truly believe that this program and others like it are what make a difference in people's lives. Cutting the funding for these programs basically turns the prisons into human warehouses. People who desperately need help to change their behaviors and thinking patterns will fall through the cracks. Then they will be released back into your communities without the necessary skills to change their old behaviors. The only way to stop this from happening is to continue to fund programs that work. Give inmates the opportunity to learn and change and grow by fully funding all programs inside correctional facilities here in Oregon. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you very much.
The next three, Damiana Merriweather, Angela Kimball, Dennis McCaffrey. And just a reminder that you each have 5 minutes.
Madam Chair, so I'll just go ahead and get started. For the record, my name is Damiana Merriweather, and I am here today in two capacities, really. One is in my capacity as the co-chair for the Human Services Coalition of Oregon, which is a broad coalition of consumers and advocates and providers of human services across populations here in Oregon. The second is in my professional capacity as lobbyist on behalf of community not-for-profit alcohol and drug treatment programs. And that is, those two pieces combined together fit perfectly with what I want to talk to you about briefly today, which is the alternate incarceration program. I know that there are many, many other issues here before you today that people are speaking to you about. I know that there are many people here who can speak to you about their own experiences with many prison programs and their proposals. I want to talk to you a little bit about what I know about AIP. And lots of folks here are going to talk dollars with you, and I want to talk a little common sense about how you as legislators choose to make wise investments for the long term in the public safety of our communities. Last weekend, I was out in Big City, Oregon, which is a lovely little town. If any of you have traveled there, it's a long ways away from where I live in Portland, and even longer still from where I grew up in Southern Oregon. And it was my first time there. And I was there along with one with several of your colleagues in the House Health and Human Services Committee, chaired by Representative Delto. And while we were there, we took the opportunity to visit with the program director of New Directions, which is both community-based, who runs both community-based alcohol and drug treatment programs, but also runs the alternative incarceration program at the Powder River Correctional Facility. And we had a really tremendous opportunity to see what that actually looks like in real terms on a day-to-day basis. And what they do out there is they have 150 inmates who have been chosen to participate in this program that combines intensive alcohol and drug treatment, structured activities, and education and skills building. They have 15 hours a day that are designated what they do every single day, those inmates. It's incredibly structured. And they have another 100 inmates who are waiting for their turn to get into the program. This program isn't for everyone. It's not for violent offenders. It's not for offenders who have person crimes. These are for people who have been selected because they will succeed. They will overcome they are likely to overcome their addictions, learn skills and tools, and be able to return to their communities as participants and members of their communities, and not as what would likely happen, which is if they did not participate, which is return as people who are still addicts and will return to their old behaviors, reoffend, and end up reincarcerated. This is a program that has demonstrated to work. It saves us dollars in terms of the cost for those individual inmates who complete the program and successfully leave incarceration. But in a bigger sense, it saves our communities the heartache of having people cycle through incarceration, not get the tools that they need in order to successfully return to communities, reoffend, create new victims of crime, and end up incarcerated again. I am here today to ask you to please restore the funds that were removed from this program in both the governor's and the co-chair's budget. It's $2 million, which in the scheme of the larger budget is a relatively small amount of money, but the impact that this has is tremendous. So the only other piece I want to point out is sort of the other pieces that connect to this. Over the last several biennia, through scarcity of resources, community access to treatment programs has been reduced dramatically. The ability of people who are in community setting, who are already out, who have not been incarcerated, who need alcohol and drug treatment to get that treatment before they get to the point of becoming people who commit crimes either directly related to their drug activity or so that they can support their drug activity, just doesn't exist in the same capacity. So we're shrinking that capacity externally. And then we're incarcerating people when they commit crimes. It makes no sense to then continue to not provide those tools to intercede. What I would love to see is for us to re-strengthen those community programs so that we can intercede with people before they find themselves also as criminals who've harmed themselves and harmed other members of the community. We know that approximately 70% of the people who are in our correctional facilities have a direct relationship with alcohol and drug abuse that either directly or indirectly caused their placement there. And at the same time, you are all considering no fewer than 10 pieces of legislation related to methamphetamine alone this session that would create new crimes, define new crimes, or increase penalties. So while we're seeing all of that, it just seems backwards to me.
May I ask you to start wrapping up?
It just seems backwards to me to do anything short of at least maintaining this really successful program. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you. I'm happy to answer any questions or direct you to folks who actually run those programs, and would invite you to come and see what we do in those correctional facilities in terms of turning people around. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Kimball.
Chair Gordley and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Angela Kimball, and I'm here representing the community mental health programs. I'd also like to note that I'm a member of Oregon Partners in Crisis and served on the Department of Corrections Managing Mental Illness in Prison Task Force. And as a representative of the community mental health programs and an advocate for mental health and addiction services, I never really expected that my passion would bring me before you to talk about corrections budgets. But sadly, prisons and jails are where a disproportionate number of individuals with mental illness or co-occurring disorders are ending up. And what I want to note to you is that as an advocate, I've heard a lot of stories of people who are in jail or in prison with mental illness or with addictions. But what really strikes at my heart is a mother who lives not far from me. And her son cycled in and out of prison and out of jail after he was struck with paranoid schizophrenia. Struck before he had become enrolled in any sort of program. He got treatment in jail, he got treatment in prison, he'd be released, only to fall apart again. But after the last discharge, he disappeared. He's never been heard from again. And that strikes at me in a way I cannot fathom, the pain of never knowing where your child is again. And that's what's happening, because we have three times more individuals with mental illness in our prisons than exist in the general population. We have an astounding number with addictions disorders, and a multitude of those have both mental illness and a substance abuse disorder together. And as community mental health programs, we see the people falling through the cracks. Our own budgets have been devastated with the loss of Oregon Health Plan Standard. And so we ask of you that you restore the alcohol and drug and treatment programs that were in the corrections budget and are now scheduled to be cut, because we know we cannot adequately serve those individuals in the community to the degree that we really need to do. And in addition, as a member of the Managing Mental Illness in the Prison Task Force, I have to note that our recommendations included that corrections have transitional units to house people with special needs, and that there needs to be vastly increased training. Corrections staff do not have the training to deal with these issues. And in addition, they are so short-staffed in terms of simply having mental health professionals to deal with the thousands who have mental health issues. Those aren't even in the budget. They never even made it to the governor's budget. And so we simply ask of you that you consider those things and realize that our communities are impacted when those things are not part of the corrections budget. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you. Sir?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dennis McCaffrey. I come to you as a concerned citizen. I do not have the types of backgrounds that many of the people who have spoken to you earlier today have. However, I am very much interested in the wise use of public money, partly because I'm a taxpayer and partly because I'm a citizen of the state of Oregon. Oregon is the state I choose to live in. I'm not originally from here. I returned to Oregon in 1997, and it still has more things that I like and fewer things that I don't like than any other state. But I was aware when I came back that things were going badly here in Oregon in certain ways. I was alarmed by Measure 11, and I was alarmed by seeing the increasing construction of various types of prison facilities, county jails, and also the state facilities, as well as certain other things that I think have not gone well. It seemed to me that Oregon was off on an excellent start with the Oregon Health Program, and it is now almost completely in shambles, and it really shouldn't have. And so, coming to you as a person who is concerned about these kinds of things, and having listened to the testimony that came before me, and having presented to you a small written paper that I am not going to read from now, it seems to me that the key for you to putting together a sensible and effective budget for corrections begins with stopping prison construction. There is no, in my opinion, poorer use of public funds than prison construction, especially in the massive amounts that prisons take. In other words, there may be, as you pick through the state budget, a few idle expenditures that you say could easily be eliminated. But there is nothing of the magnitude of corrections that is soaking up so much money and providing so little public good. And so it seems to me that the key to getting on the right track about being smart on crime is stop prison construction. That's pretty much what I've said in my testimony written. I thank you very much for your time. It's a very simple statement that I want to make. I would like to point out that there were a few other people who had wanted to testify, could not be here today. I have left written testimony from them with your staff.
Very good.
I very much appreciate your service to our state, and thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Mr. McCaffrey. You left the state for a while and then came back?
Yes.
Where did you live before coming back?
I was in Maryland.
Thank you so much. Glad you came back.
I'm glad I'm here.
Thank you. Dana Hepper. And again, I do apologize if I'm mispronouncing names here. Brian DeLashmet. And Ann Stratley.
Chair Gordley, members of the committee, thank you so much for giving me the time to speak today. My name is Dana Hepper. I'm the Salem Kaiser organizer with Stand for Children, and I'm here to testify against building the Madras prison and in favor of smart on crime alternatives. As you all probably know, Stand for Children is a statewide organization with more than 1,500 members. We ask the adults of Oregon to use their political voice and vote on behalf of children because, as you know, children have no vote. You're used to hearing us testify on more traditional children's issues, child care, education, the big one. But we feel that the decisions we make about public safety and corrections are children's issues. For example, 20,000 Oregon children have at least one parent in a correctional facility. I was a teacher. I taught these kids. I know that they can be successful, but it's very difficult for them to be successful, more difficult than many other children. When they are in a classroom that's the second largest, that has the second largest class sizes in the nation, as we have here in Oregon, and one of the shortest school years. Over the past few months, we've been advocating for a responsible level of school funding, which means $5.4 billion. That's the level which will stop cuts in most districts in Oregon. And during this time, we've been told that the legislature has a choice. And that choice is a difficult one. We've been told that that choice is between funding programs that are important for seniors and those with disabilities and funding programs for children. And it's frustrating to learn that that's not actually the choice that we have this biennium. We have an opportunity to reject this false choice that we've been given by House leadership by doing the right thing with the Department of Corrections budget, which is the fastest increasing budget in the state. We can do this by stopping the building of the Madras prison. This can be a big piece of the solution. Just this biennium, as you've heard, starting the construction of the Madras prison would cost $22 million. Just to provide a couple contrasts, the governor's budget cut $11 million from Head Start, so that's only half the price of the Madras prison this biennium. And that's going to leave 1,000 children who are eligible for Head Start not being served. And it also decreases the amount of eligible children we are serving to 50%. To provide another contrast, I work here in Salem, and we're looking at how we're going to deal with budget cuts this biennium. If we wanted to increase or decrease class sizes by one, it would cost us only $3.4 million, and that would mean not only decreasing class sizes for kids, but providing 45 new teaching jobs in our district. This is especially frustrating in light of the fact that there are enough beds. What we don't have in this state is enough desks. So this biennium, I ask you to reject the seniors versus children choice that we've been given, and instead really think about what we value as a state and make smart choices here in the Department of Corrections that can save us money that we can then invest in education and other social services that are a smarter investment in our state. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony.
For the record, I'm Ann Staley. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I'm a retired high school English teacher, and I teach now at in the graduate school at Lewis and Clark. I understand how an educational
setting can... Would you hold your comments just for a moment? I want to wait until you have the committee's attention. Please go forward.
I understand how an educational setting can encourage and support change. And this is why I'm asking you to restore funding for the prison programs. A few words about how I come to be here this afternoon speaking for prisoners and witnessing, really, for education. 3 years ago, my younger brother, Tom, died homeless, alone on the streets with his drug and alcohol problems. He had spent time in prison in the South, and I don't mean Southern Oregon, I mean South with a capital S. And there were no programs which would have helped him address his addictions, his way of thinking, or his deepest self. A social service worker I talked to on the phone said, there's nothing up there for them. And after his death, I felt like I needed to do something, and I wasn't sure what it could be, but I wanted to do something for people like my brother who need every which way of encouragement and hope and understanding. So the opportunity to teach writing classes at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, working with women serving terms from 3 years to life, has given me the chance I wanted. And also an incredible glimpse on the inside, what it's like to work there and what it's like to live there. There are some women who don't choose to take part in programs, the programs that are offered by volunteers and also programs offered by the educational program. But most of the women do participate, and they're thrilled, really, to have evening classes of any kind. They want to learn anything. And after a day of working at their jobs in the prison, they have the opportunities to do quilting, to be members of a book club, to take computer classes, to be involved in nonviolent communication training. And they really love to do these things. They want to change their lives inside so they're able to live them outside. They love learning, and I mean just about anything. They know that the classes that they attend give them hope and the opportunity for successful lives when they're released into our neighborhoods and workplaces and churches and schools. 95% of all those in prison, 95% of them are returning to us. And of course, we want them to be return as changed human beings, people capable of parenting and working, paying taxes and voting. We must be deeply invested in their changes, and we know from research that simply doing time is not an effective change agent. As it is for all of us, change means education, education, education. Programs like Turning Point and WICS, Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Pathfinders, represent less than 2.2% of the DOC budget, but they provide education, drug and alcohol rehab, and job skills that are strategically cost-effective. We do not now need another prison. We need intelligently designed, multi-pronged programs for those who are already there. Thank you for your willingness to listen and for this opportunity to speak to you. I thank you for all that you do beyond this one small area in behalf of all of us.
And again, we thank you very much for coming forward. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I actually am coming before you with a couple of different hats. I'm Brian DeLashmit. I represent the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, represent the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers, and I'll get to that in just a minute as far as 1145, and then also I represent the Oregon Council of Police Associations and its members that work in community corrections and in the jail settings at local levels. Actually, I just had a couple of very brief comments. I've sat through most of the hearings, and as you well know, I've been here a number of years, more years than I would want to count, and seen evolutions in budgets. And in many cases, what you see as you spend more time here is that we've gone there, we've tried that, or we've done this, or we've reorganized that. And I kind of chuckle when I go back and figure out those things that we've attempted to do and haven't worked, and then they cycle back around. But a couple of themes that I want to give you that I think really need to resonate in this budget and other budgets are those things that, in fact, are well-founded historically and really need to be looked at very carefully. And one of those is in the area that you've previously heard a number of people testify, and that's about mental health, alcohol, and drug issues in our facilities. I don't know how many times either, and I'll briefly put another hat, the Oregon Nurses Association, but I've heard prevention, or alternatives. And from the correction officers, I hear in many cases them saying there are a lot of people in these prisons that should not be in these prisons, that they have issues that result from their mental illness. And we need to figure out on a much longer term basis how to deal with these issues, either in the communities or as a state as a whole. And I guess what I would pledge to you is, as we work through this budget and other budgets, I am very interested on behalf of all of my clients in addressing that issue. I bring that issue up every session. I haven't seen the whole master plan yet, but I think we really need to get there. You've heard a lot about the alcohol and drug treatment programs. I mean, obviously, we know a lot about recidivism and alcohol meth epidemic. You've heard all of that. I'm not going to go into that. But obviously, again, wearing a number of hats, we're very interested in that. One very specific issue that I will talk to you about that I just about got tackled on at a recent Association of Oregon Corrections Employees meeting. I met with the board about a variety of things, and immediately after that was the nurses were meeting. And these are not ONA nurses. These are AOCE nurses. These are the nurses that work in the state pen and the OSCI. And they've been telling me for a long period of time about the lack of resources in the health services side, and specifically about the inability with their staffing to do what it needs to be done for those that are very ill, either with health-related issues, mental health issues, and a whole variety of other things. And I guess I would suggest to you as you go through this budget, and I know it's a matter of resources, but we look at better ways to use the salaries and the resources in the health services area. That makes more sense than paying overtime to these folks because they're short-staffed. Let's get some more nurses. Or rather than hiring agency nurses that are at a cost that are 2 to 3 times of that in which you actually paid a decent wage to recruit and retain nurses. And I do understand there's a nursing shortage. I've talked to other committee members in another committee about the nursing shortage. But the reality is there are enough nurses out there. If there's an enticement to come to work, if in fact the job is rewarding and the pay is satisfactory, there are people out there we can recruit back in. And with that, I'll make one additional comment. Director Williams asked me to tell you that the department is doing a very good job, and I guess I would echo that. I've known Max for a long time. I've had a number of meetings with him. He's a person that I put a lot of faith in, and so I would hope collectively as legislators, as the department, and as constituents that we have the ability to work through these issues. And thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. DeLashmit. We, too, I believe I can say this for the committee, have a great deal of respect for Director Williams and his professionalism and the professionals that work with him. As you were making your comments, I want you to know that he flushed to a totally different color sitting back there on the back row. But thank you for your comments.
Thank you.
Terry, is it Quinteros?
Yes.
Please come forward. Miguel Telez and Teresa Huggins. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Chair Gordley and members of the subcommittee, my name is Terry Quinteros, and I'm the Program Director of Crime Survivors for Community Service Safety. Excuse me. We are a program of the Western Prison Project. We are survivors of crime and violence who are working for criminal justice reform. I have worked with victims of domestic and sexual violence in the state of Oregon since 1989. I also had the opportunity to work with the WICS program in the late 90s as well. I'm also presenting my testimony today as a survivor of sexual abuse. And as a survivor of a violent crime, I want to urge you to support the programs in the prison and to oppose the building of the prison in Madras. Crime Survivors for Community Safety consists of members who are all survivors of crimes, sometimes very violent crimes. As survivors, we are working for a safer world for everyone. Not only do we want the people who have harmed us to be held accountable, we also want to address the problems that were originally present that made the violence possible. We also find that it's just as important to prevent future crime and violence. When all of these goals are present, we have a very complex and holistic approach to crime justice reform. As a survivor of violent crime, all of these goals are very important to me. It is also important to me as a resident of the state to know that my government is thinking in long-term strategic manner regarding the prevention of crime and violence. When I was an employee of WICS at Columbia River Correctional Institution, I experienced firsthand the power of these programs in prison. Many people were motivated to turn their lives around and worked hard to meet the many requirements of being in those programs. While in the WICS program, women had the opportunity to not only learn new skills that would lend to their success on the outside, but to also look at the circumstances in their lives that led to crime and incarceration. Some of the women in the program had committed very serious offenses, sometimes very violent crimes against other people. When they were able to examine their life, they were often able to uncover horrendous violence that they themselves had survived. The overwhelming majority of women in the class had experienced some form of sexual abuse or assault in their lifetime. As a fellow survivor, what this reinforced for me was that we did not invest nearly enough into the services for survivors of violence and crime, and that we do not invest nearly enough into prevention for future violence and crime. The women who were able to get into the program were some of the very few lucky ones. They had the opportunity finally to get some of the services that they so desperately needed their entire lives. I was constantly turning women away from the program because there was not enough space in the classroom. The men in the institution were always coming up to me in the hallway and asking if there was some way that they could get in or if there was some way to start a similar program for them. This was heartbreaking because we both knew that would increase their chances of success on the outside and that they so desperately needed those services. As a survivor, I want to know that other survivors and prevention of future violence and crime will be the first programs that we fund. Instead, they are an afterthought. As a survivor, when I see the few programs that are available to people in prison at risk of being cut again, I see services and prevention remaining an afterthought. An afterthought not only to the Department of Corrections, but an afterthought to the state of Oregon. When I hear the threat of a new prison being built, when all other human services are being cut, I once again hear that survivors and prevention are an afterthought for the Department of Corrections and to the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Teresa Huggins, and I'm a volunteer for Crime Survivors for Community Safety. I'm a survivor of rape and a former drug addict. I'm here today to ask you to support and increase the vital programs within the prison system. As a rape survivor, that means I was able to get beyond the pain and deep humiliation that my rape caused me. But this survival didn't come easy. I spent many years hating and punishing myself, calling myself stupid and dumb. And the way I coped with my pain was through drugs and alcohol, which put me in situations where I was sexually assaulted again. Instead of crying, I would tell myself that I was dumb and stupid. And I can't tell you how this self-talk perpetuated my cycle of pain and drug use. About 8 years ago, I hit rock bottom. I was married to a heroin addict. I was living in someone's basement, fighting over my next hit of cocaine and hating myself. I didn't care how I felt, what I looked like, or how I acted. You know, I thought I was going insane. Literally, I believed I was going insane. But something inside of myself told me to leave, to just walk out of there and never look back. So I did. You know, I was really lucky because I was able to move in with my father. And that was only because I promised him that I wouldn't use drugs. And I really meant it at the time. But the change, it doesn't come easy. So I participated in programs, drug treatment programs, and self-empowerment and improvement programs. I got a job and started paying my bills. But the thing I'm most proud of is that I got my bachelor's degree at Portland State University. And I'm here today to ask you to increase the vital programs that help people in the prison, you know, people that, to help them change and make these changes. Because as a survivor, I understand the importance of education and self-improvement programs. And as a former drug addict, I understand the importance of drug treatment. I know you've heard several times today about the 75% of the people in prison have drug and alcohol problems. And I know that if we increase the vital programs within these prisons, that we can help them, that we can help them make these changes. And by doing this, we will also help society, because I know it will reduce crime and violence within our society. I'd like to thank you for listening to my story and hope you take in consideration that we will be helping all survivors by doing this. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for your courage and sharing your story. Thank you so much. And your degree at Portland State University, in what area?
Political science.
Excellent. Great choice. Great school. We're going to make an exception to the applause rule. Congratulations to you.
Thank you.
Okay.
I don't know if it's a science.
Mark Brand? Brandland? Is there a Mark Brandland?
Yeah.
Annette Jolin? Calling that name again?
Yes, they are.
Trillia Puffin? And John Masso. And Mary Botkin. Trillia Puffin. Okay. You want to swing that microphone right around in front of you and identify yourself for the record. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Gordley and members of the Chair Committee. My name is Trillia Puffin. I live in Portland, Oregon. I'm here today to ask you to fully fund education, drug and alcohol treatment in prisons, and the alternative incarceration programs. I'm a former prisoner. I served 15 months in Oregon Department of Corrections. 5 years ago, when I was 20 years old, I was addicted to drugs and living on the streets, and I was charged with 3 counts of Measure 11 June 5 years ago and was facing over 13 years in prison. I got a plea bargain for 30 months not under Measure 11 with immediate eligibility for the Summit Boot Camp Program. I got my GED at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. I was a high school dropout.
and I was able to start the summit program a few months later. I spent 8 months in the summit program and graduated October 4.5 years ago. Since I was released from prison, I've worked as a peer advocate for other homeless youth for a year. I've completed a couple of terms at Portland Community College. I'm applying to go to Portland Community College and then transfer to PSU to work on my bachelor's for the fall. After I was incarcerated, my mother told me that for the previous several years to when I was incarcerated, she regularly had nightmares that I was dead. And I just want to ask you to fully fund prison programs and the summit program. I went through the 12 steps. I got counseling on how to look for a job, how to interview for a job, how to write a resume. If I had spent my time in prison in general population, I don't know where I'd be today. I don't know if I would have been able to find employment when I got out.
You're doing just fine.
Thank you. It's still very difficult to find employment with felony convictions on your record and without being able to say, you know, I graduated a treatment program, I've done this, I've done that to employers when I'm looking for a job. I don't know where I'd be today. So I'm here today to ask you to fund education and alcohol and drug treatment and alternative to incarceration programs in prison. Thank you.
Well, again, it takes a great deal of courage and confidence, to come forward and share your story in a setting like this. And we just thank you so much for being willing to come forward and share
thank
your story.
Thank you.
Representative Hansen?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. As a parent, I can assure you that your mom must be awfully proud of the changes that you've made in your life now.
Yeah, I talk to my mom on the phone almost every day now.
Thank you. Sir?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Masso, and you're going to hear it again. Pretty much some of the same things have already been said. I grew up in a dysfunctional and crime-influenced environment, leading a criminal lifestyle centered around the use, production, and distribution of drugs as a mainstay to my existence. And believe me, I understand in the deepest sense this methamphetamine problem. This persisted until I was 38, beginning in my early teens. That's about 21 years that I spent involved in this kind of a situation. I experienced many arrests and incarcerations. My last incarceration was in 1989-90. I got a year in the federal prison system for a drug-related charge. But I was ready for change. And I took advantage of the programs that were in there, any program that would help me, and I followed that on the outside. These programs really were a godsend and a lifesaver to me. And those that affected my behavior. I'm convinced that these programs paid for themselves many times over in saving in related to in further incarcerations, medical expenses related to substance use, emotional and social damage caused by this sort of lifestyle, both to myself and those that were impacted by my behavior. And believe me, I caused a lot of problems. This was a long process. My dysfunctional behavior was not corrected in one day. It took many hours of intense effort on my part and the program providers to place me where I am at today. Where am I at today is drug-free since 1989, a stable and solid member in my community where I contribute to the overall well-being of those who are impacted by my actions, not to mention self-sustaining in a legal manner rather than a drain on both in a financial and social context. I have nothing but gratitude for all those that have made these services available. Through the availability of these programs, I am giving back to society rather than drain its resources in destructive behaviors. Not only have I stayed drug-free, I've graduated from college with my 4-year degree in social work, obtained my alcohol and drug counseling certificate, a CDAC, become a taxpayer, a good neighbor, a homeowner in my community. I absolutely know, without a shadow of a doubt, that none of this would have been possible without this lifeline these programs provided. I know this in retrospect, as my dysfunctions were too severe to simply change on good intentions by themselves. At best, state programs have always been more in demand than available. Now, with the severe increase of incarcerated individuals entering the state correctional system. We need more than ever to provide funding to match this influx. Now there is talk and effort to wipe away what little is left when the time we so badly need to increase the availability both inside and outside the institutions. I believe in accountability. I believe the state is morally and ethically bound to provide these programs. I firmly believe that these offenders, those offenders whose needs to benefit from them, enroll in them until they have established genuine and long-lasting changes in attitude and behavior. Criminal thinking and substance abuse get well entrenched in people, and they stay there. The longer you stay in prison, the less you do about it, the longer it's going to be there, and the more damage you're going to cause. I can say that without refute. Fight for substance abuse in a crime-free society by supporting programs that are known to work. Keep and increase these needed prison programs. Respectfully, thanks.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Yes, ma'am.
We appreciate it very much. Hi, Ms. Botkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Mary Botkin, and I've testified in front of this committee a lot this session. Today I'm here representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and we represent about 3,000 men and women working in the correctional facilities around Oregon, and we also represent folks who are working in community corrections as well. I'm going to cut my testimony and make it a little briefer than it is. Many have already talked about the issues that we care about, and I know, Madam Chair, that you have a copy of our program that we put together for the Human Resources Department asking for a mental health action plan for the Department of Corrections. But I want to take a minute and talk about that, because I think that this is a critical part of what keeps the prison system, or what will keep the prison system functioning in the future, is some kind of a plan that professionalizes the training and the needs of the correctional officers who are working in the prison system to handle the increased levels of mentally ill inmates. I am not talking about inmates with a personality disorder. I'm not talking about anger management. I'm not talking about, you know, some of those kind of behavioral problems that sometimes get cast into the same pool as mental illness. I'm talking about chronic diagnosed mental illness for which one cannot say no to drugs. And we need to figure out how we're going to manage that population and how to help the officers and the staff who are working in the prison system to identify those needs early and get those inmates the assistance that they need immediately so that there is no decomposition and so that those individuals are handled appropriately and properly, quickly and efficiently, and put into an environment where they can receive the assistance and the treatment that they need to recompensate, to de-escalate their behavior, and to restabilize their personality or their mental illness at that time. In a perfect world, we would have transitional programs. I know Angela talked about this a little bit. We have actually explored it extensively with our mental health professionals and our correctional professionals. We believe that the department absolutely must develop some type of transitional housing for mentally ill inmates. One of the terms that's commonly used is a term called step-down beds or a step-down facility. And I don't want to think about it as a step-down because I think there's also a step-up. We want to think about it as transitioning. Transitioning for the inmate who is decomposing in the environment and needs some assistance to kind of get back on track and stabilized, but also is not suddenly thrust back into the mainstream population of the institution, but rather moved through that transition project back into the institution in a more stable way, for the lack of a better term. I think that there is a question that this committee needs to ask itself, and I know that you are, but I'm going to say it anyway, and that is, what kind of prisons are we going to have? Are we, you know, we can run dungeons. They're cheap, they're efficient, they don't cost a lot, and, you know, the officers don't need a lot of training to run a dungeon. But dungeons don't create a better world. And behind every inmate is at least one victim. And in order to transition that inmate back into society and not create new victims, we need to decide what we're going to provide while they're in prison. And our officers will tell you programs, 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 programs. All kinds of programs. A busy inmate is a useful inmate. It is something, you know, idle hands are not good in prison. Folks need to be in educational programs. They need to be in drug and alcohol programs. They need to be in religious programs. You know, they need to be working every day, all day. That's what's going to make them better. And at some point, you know, we need to have the conversation about work programs. Sometimes it's just a matter of teaching somebody to get up and go to work in the morning. You know, not everybody had somebody doing that for them. And those are very important things. And I'm going to be one of the people that say MADRS isn't a wish list issue for us. It is a critical need. Coffee Creek expansion isn't a wish list for us. It's a critical need. I can tell you we've been there, done that, when we talk about moving inmates out of state. You know, I was here for that cycle when we moved them all out of state, and when we brought them back, they'd been sexually assaulted. Some were pregnant. Some had just been abused. But generally speaking, it didn't work. Inmates need to be in Oregon where they can see their family, be with people who love them and who they love. They need to be with their children when possible. MADRS and Coffee Creek is an Oregon solution to an Oregon problem, and we need to fix it.
I'm going to ask you to
and
make
I'm
more close.
I'm
thank you.
Done. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And thank
and
you.
I do have written testimony that I'll make available to the kids.
Please. And thank you all to this panel. I want to make sure that we don't overlook Mark Brandland. Can I call that name again? Mr. Brandland? Annette Jolin? Commissioner Nato and Sheriff Ramirez. They did not come back. And I'm going to call up Steve Dole. And if you'd like to begin, sir.
Thanks, Chairman Gordley. And the rest of the committee members. My name is Mark Brandland. I am from Portland, Oregon. I'm a real estate broker and consultant. I've also, for the last 2 years, been serving on a governor's advisory council for alcohol and drug abuse programs. So I'm here in that capacity.
Thank you for your service on that body.
It's been tough sometimes. We have, as a council, in the 2 years that I've been on the council, we have struggled with how to deal with the cuts that the budget has required that the state takes in getting rid of beds. We have struggled with how to deal with parity, and that we treat alcoholism and drug addiction like we do with the same in the other medical issues that the insurance companies are dealing with. And as my appearance here today, again, this is a struggle for us. How do we continue to provide, first of all, how do we not cut what's been taken away from the corrections departments as far as alcohol and drug treatment programs, but how do we get more programs in them? It's been proven time and time and time and time again over the last 25 or 30 years that drug and alcohol treatment works. It saves taxpayers money. It gets people back on the right track of their life, whether they're incarcerated or whether they're not incarcerated. We know treatment works. Our stance and our position is, for the state of Oregon, we need to have those programs not only reinstituted but expanded that are currently inside the Department of Corrections. We know that that alcoholism and drug addiction is one of the few issues that we face today that turns its victims into abusers. If you come from an alcoholic home and you're 4 or 5 years old and you walk into mom and dad who are suffering from a hangover because they've been out drinking or drugging for the last 2 or 3 days, there is a huge impact on that child. We know that the impact on a 12 or 13-year-old when one of them has to tell the rest of their friends that mom and daddy aren't coming back because they're locked up for a while, and what they do to go about getting some self-esteem and the way that self-esteem plays out when they're asked to be a part of a gang. We know the downfall of all of those, and we know the ramifications of all of those. And I may be sitting here preaching to the choir, and my position is a lot of times I don't know whether I am or I'm not. I know there's been a lot of people behind me who have testified about how their lives have changed. I know there's a lot of people behind me who know a whole lot more about the finances and a lot of other issues that have to do with the state. So sometimes my role is just kind of, I get logged in the middle and trying to convince you that, and this is the hardest thing I think that we have to do, is that when you put money up front, you don't have any way to really examine the results other than sometimes the only thing we can say is we didn't have this many more people in corrections. Or sometimes we can just go and say, you know, we had 1,500 more people that got through treatment, and we really don't know the impact of what those 1,500 people had on their communities. I do know this. When people do go through treatment, they become advocates for treatment. We've had a lot of those people show up today. They become advocates for how the families are dealing with their drug addiction, chemical dependency issues, and mental health. So, again, all I can do is sit here and encourage you. And this, you know, this is a tough one because sometimes it's when I ask people to go get educated about this, sometimes their closest education are people who don't know a thing about what we're talking about. So as being involved, as I've been involved in this for the last 2 years, I encourage you, if you don't have enough information about this, please, please, please go visit Powder River Correctional Institute. Go talk to some of the people who have been through treatment. Don't talk to the probation and parole folks because they need their job. They are overstaffed and under, you know, way overworked. Talk to the people who have gone through the programs like you've had experience here today. And I just think I ran out of words. So thank you very much for the opportunity to participate.
Representative Wisnut.
I'd like to express my thanks to my friend Mark Finlan for serving on the Governor's Council too. Keep up there. We're doing all we can. I'm sure you that this committee has talked about the need for the drug and alcohol money.
Thank you.
And I would just add that preaching to the choir is really okay. A good song should be sung as often as possible. Thank you so much for your service.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Dole?
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Steve Dole. I am president of Crime Victims United of Oregon, and I'm also here today as a member of Parents of Murdered Children of Oregon. You know, I really had a number of things I wanted to touch on today. I've given you all a presentation that we do in a PowerPoint form that time doesn't permit me to go through, and I hope to be able to share some thoughts with you on that. However, in everything I thought about as I sat here today, with all the talk about the costs of incarceration, sometimes we don't talk about what it costs not to incarcerate. And so what I do is I'm going to lay some of my comments aside, which I'll submit to you, and I'd like to talk to you about what it costs not to incarcerate, but I'd like to point out a couple things to you. For 25 years, we neglected the system. For 25 years, while the crime rate was spiraling at almost 7.9 times, or 800, near 800% increase, we built exactly 400 prison beds in this state. We talk about alternatives to incarceration. 72% of the felons who are convicted in this state never go to prison. We have alternatives to incarceration. 67% of the people who are in the prison system are violent offenders. 22% are chronic property offenders. I've heard a number of people who stood up today and told moving stories about being involved in drugs. I noticed there was a lot of caveats to saying, well, I served in federal prison. Federal laws are tougher on drugs. Oregon laws are not. You have to work to get into prison for drug offenses in Oregon, mostly for distributors and mostly for manufacturers. But let me get back to what I started with, and that's the cost of not incarcerating. In the same year that my daughter Lisa was murdered, there was a young man in Portland named David Nelson. And David Nelson was involved in a street family with a man named Grant Charbonneau, who was about 6 years his senior. They murdered Grant's father in North Portland, where I grew up. They also murdered a young woman named Misty Largo. And then they murdered a young man named Robert Stanton. Mr. Charbonneau and two others went to prison. David Nelson was the man who murdered Mr. Stanton. Mr. Stanton was 15. Mr. Nelson at the time was 16. He was remanded to the adult system, and he was sent to prison for 13 years, and he served 11 of those. Had Measure 11 been in effect at the time, he would have served 14 more years. It would have cost the state $330,000 approximately to keep him for those 14 years. But he was released about this time during the last legislative session. Within 60 days of his release, he formed his own street family. He was now 27 years old. And 12 of them together took Jessica Kate Williams, one of the bridges in Portland, assaulted her, stabbed her over and over and over, and then lit her on fire. Mr. Nelson just pled guilty to aggravated murder. He's going to prison for the rest of his life. We should have done that the first time. But now he's also in a ring of crime, taking down 12 more people with him, or 11 more people with him. 9 of them have already been convicted, and 2 of them are still awaiting trial for aggravated murder. All of those convictions fell under Measure 11. The 2 awaiting trial, one can be convicted of, they're both up for conviction for aggravated murder. One, because he was a juvenile, cannot get the death penalty. The other could possibly get the death penalty. Here's the point. So far, just in incarceration costs for Mr. Nelson and the 9 that have gone down with him, it's going to cost us approximately $3.6 million to incarcerate those people. That's not including investigation and police costs. That's not including court costs. That's not including indigent defense. That's not including prosecution or appeals. By the time the other 2 are convicted, and by the time we throw in all those attendant costs and appeals, we're probably talking around $8 or $9 million. We heard the other day that we could save $40 million by letting people out early. Well, that's almost 10% of that with this one murder. So while I had a lot of things to throw at you today, but you've heard most of them at some point, you know, I could give you all the facts and figures again that DOC already gave you. I want you to think about not the costs of incarceration, but the costs of not incarcerating. And while we've heard a lot about all the people who commit the crimes here today, we didn't hear much about the psychological, emotional, physical damage, the blood and the tears that are brought to the victims of those people. And I hope that you do not forget that in your considerations. And last but not least, I'd like to thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing me today. I'd like to thank you all for your service, and I also would like to thank Max Williams. I will tell you this, I feel more comfortable with the Department of Corrections today than I've felt with it for a number of years now, and I thank Max for his service.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dole. And again, thank you both gentlemen. We appreciate you coming forward with your testimony.
Thanks for hearing us.
Representative Greenlick. And Representative Shields. And I believe, have we missed anyone?
these will be the last two folks to testify. And welcome both of you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you for hearing this important issue and having the patience to stay with it. One of the things I've learned in my brief time in the legislature is that good lawmaking is a combination of good policy and good politics, and that it's always an issue to balance these things. So I want to talk first from the perspective of a scientist and to talk a bit about policy. I've spent my years as a scientist studying things like substance abuse research. In 1971, I was taken into the National Academy of Sciences, the Institute of Medicine, and served over the next 35 years on a variety of committees of the Institute of Medicine, many of which I learned more in doing than I brought knowledge to the field. But in 1998, I was named chair of an Institute of Medicine committee to look at the question of how to bring knowledge into the practice in the area of the substance abuse. And we studied for 9 months the problem of creating knowledge in a vacuum and then not having it apply into the practice field. And I was fortunate to be the editor of that report, what became a landmark report on bridging the gap between knowledge and practice in the field of substance abuse. One of the things that we pointed out in that is there were a variety of problems in being able to bring knowledge into the field and making it operational. And sometimes they were research problems, sometimes they were problems in the practice field, but sometimes they were in the area of policy. And we created the notion that these three things needed to fit together in order to optimize the system. We learned in that study, and we made recommendations that changed a lot of things, changed the way the National Institute of Drug Abuse is now doing research. We've created a 17 research unit network with 110 practice sites studying this field around the country. But among the things where we learned sometimes it was most difficult to bring knowledge into practice was in the area of corrections and criminal justice. And I was sort of proud to watch in the last session SB 267 that actually made it the policy of the state to bring evidence into practice in corrections and in mental health and in substance abuse here. But as I look at the situation and as I look at the information from the field, I think there's no place that it can make more of a difference than in the Department of Corrections. I hear Mr. Dole talk about the cost of letting somebody out of prison. That's not what the evidence tells us what we ought to do. The evidence tells us we ought to use the opportunity of somebody being in prison to treat them so you can correct the underlying cause. 60 to 70% of all the people in prison are there because of either a mental health problem or a substance abuse problem. And for years, we put them in prison and do nothing about that. So we release them from prison, whether it's under a long Measure 11 sentence or under a short non-Measure 11 sentence. The problem is people come in with a problem. That problem is sometimes fostered inside the system, and then they're let out without making an investment in solving the problem. Evidence tells us that if we're going to let them out in 36 months or 72 months or 84 months or 15 years, if we don't put resources into solving the underlying problem that brought them into the system, they're going to go back out, cause problems, make murders, burn people up, and they're going to be back in again. My son is a criminal defense attorney, and he tells me about how sometimes in trying to deal with a plea bargain, he works with the client to try and find the proper solution, sometimes a slightly longer sentence, that will get their client the help that they need. And that he feels his job representing a client is to help get them what it is they need in order to ultimately live a successful life. Last week I visited the the Powder River Correctional Institution in Baker. We were there on a site visit for Health and Human Services and saw the operation, talked with the people that ran 178 beds, or 278 beds in the institution. They're running 178 as a treatment program. You had testimony on that earlier in the day. It's quite extraordinary, the kind of evidence that they're producing about how effective they can be in reducing recidivism and rebuilding successful lives. And in fact, they're treating probably as many as 50 of the other 100 in that institution. We really need to look to what we know, and what we know is these kind of problems, these kind of solutions work to solve the underlying problem. They help people create productive lives that can pay taxes. They help reduce recidivism. They help bring families back together. And I'm just here to thank you for worrying about this issue and to put my voice to the voices that say we cannot cut the resources for dealing with the underlying problems that bring people into the correction system. In fact, if anything, we need to try and find resources from wherever we can to expand those programs.
Thank you very much, Representative Greenland.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And we are going to lose the rest of the committee in about by 3:15, just to let you know where we are.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'll make my comments extremely brief out of courtesy to those who've been kind enough to stick around. Over 10 years, I've been working with offenders, helping them find living wage jobs and change their belief system, the way they do business, drug and alcohol treatment issues, so that they can turn their lives around and not reoffend. And there are essentially three points that I'd like to make that I think probably have already been made today, but I just want to reemphasize them. Helping people change on the inside helps them change on the outside. So we can't just have community corrections programs without any type of treatment on the inside of prisons. Likewise, we also need those treatment programs on the outside through the community corrections process. So I would just suggest that there are three issues that I wanted to talk about, and I'll just mention them and depart. One, I think we need to restore the dollars to drug and alcohol treatment on the inside of prisons. Two, I think we need to restore the money to the community corrections budget. I believe it's $18 million or $9 million. I'm not sure which, because some great treatment programs are funded through community corrections dollars. And third, you know, police officers and corrections officers are very high risk for alcoholism, drug abuse, domestic violence, and we need to help take care of those people because the ripple effects in our community, as you well know, Senator Gordley, are exponential. So we not only need to make sure they make a decent living with decent benefits, but we also need to make sure that they've got the proper training, both corrections officers as well as police officers, and I would encourage you to do what you can to fund the Department of Public Safety standards and training as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you both. We appreciate you coming in to weigh in on these issues. We appreciate it very much. Thank you. Mr. Wilson, do you have anything for the good of the order?
I don't think so.
Okay, I'll just announce again that the full Ways and Means Committee will be meeting in Portland this evening, starting at 7 p.m. at Portland Community College Cascade Campus. And the purpose of that full Ways and Means meeting is to hear public testimony on the budget. It is the first of a series of meetings held in different places around the state, opportunities for Oregonians to come and talk directly to the full Ways and Means Committee about their concerns regarding the budget. Again, I would just like to thank all of you still remaining for coming forward, for providing testimony. Believe me, your thoughts, your concerns help us look at these issues, look at them deeply, and better understand the impact, the full impact of the decisions that we're making on your behalf. And again, we thank you so much for your time this afternoon. And we are adjourned.
Excellent testimony.
Thank you.